The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alexander Kasar joins us to discuss his book, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Good question. Meanwhile, Biden has imposed additional sanctions on Russia, fully blocking two major Russian banks, sanctions on Russian debt, and more. Biden has been clear that the U.S. won't engage in the fighting, but has sent troops, aircrafts, and arms to Ukraine. Europe, in addition to the UK and Germany imposing their own penalties, is bracing for Ukrainian refugees. The U.S. troops who arrived in Poland over the past few weeks will reportedly assist in any refugee effort. The Supreme Court has formally rejected Trump's request to block his presidential documents from the January 6th committee. And a Portland man has been identified as the shooter that killed one woman and injured five others at a BLM rally over the weekend.
Reportedly a subscriber to Andy Ngo.
Andy Ngo?
Yep.
Well, that makes sense, given that his roommate was quoted and said that, quote, he talked about wanting to go out and shoot commies and Antifa all the friggin' time. In Florida, the Don't Say Gay bill continues to move through the legislature for discussion, and on Friday, an amendment was proposed that would essentially require schools to out students to their parents within 6 weeks of discovering the identity of the child. Luckily, the lawmaker was pressured into withdrawing that amendment shortly before the show today, but that bill is still egregious and could pass. And lastly, the tech gods have bestowed us with a gift. Starbucks missed a legal deadline to bust union efforts in dozens of their shops by 8 minutes. Needed to do it by noon, and they did it by 12:08. Pathetic and sad. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. Sam is out on this hump day. He really insists on continuing to make that a thing, but like, look, I can't even help it in his absence. It's my tribute to him. But he'll be back next week. Just a reminder to everybody, I'll be hosting for the rest of this week. It's been fun so far. Yeah, I mean, we'll see. It's been, couldn't have been a crazier time for him to leave with what's happening.
Nothing
with
really
Russia.
Going on, yeah.
Right. And that seems to be dominating the news. As understandably so, but there are a lot of smaller stories out there that we want to hit on this program today. I just want to also start off by giving Biden a bit of credit. I am in favor of a lot of what he's been doing over the past few days in response to this Russian aggression. He's been steadfast about no U.S. troops. Selling helicopters and planes to Ukraine or giving them to them, I think that's understandable, giving it to the government, not to, you know, covertly the militias on the ground. I think that's fair at this point. And I think sanctions targeting specifically elite oligarchs and Russian power players is a reasonable approach to what we've been dealing with.
I think on that point, though, it remains to be clear if we're going to have sanctions that are like so targeted.
Well, the point is that that's just so far, right? Because you have Boris Johnson saying this is the first tranche. If Russia goes further, there could be more sanctions. And then my analysis will change if those sanctions are less specific and targeted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I just think expect the worst on that front. Like, so that's why, like, I think, like, yes, I think we need to, I don't know what I'm trying, like, why I'm trying to quibble so much, but I do think, like,
no, I think it's
you need to,
fair.
You need to, like, be honest about what's going on with regards to Russia, but I do think, like, I don't trust these sanctions regimes to be targeted like this. I'll wait and see, I guess. Like, If that's, I'm not going to like give my affirmation to it or, you know,
fair enough,
consent to it before seeing that, oh, it actually did just target the people who are like laundering money through like New York high rises and stuff like that.
Fair enough. But a full blocking of backing of two major Russian banks, sanctions on the trading of Russian debt in European markets sounds specifically targeted towards elites. If it goes further, again, my analysis will likely change. It's just, it also is interesting. We were talking before the show about the U.S., even though Biden's getting dragged over the coals for this, is probably fairly thrilled that that this has shut down the Nord Stream pipeline effectively. Let's get into that discussion, actually, because Peter Ducey, the son of Steve Ducey and upcoming White House beat reporter, had an exchange with Jen Psaki about the threat of climate change. Now, he's essentially trying to catch the Biden administration in a lie or in a weak moment, because they had spoken about in the past a report that they'd received from the military that global warming, climate change, was the greatest national security threat that this country would face. Ducey's like, I gotcha. It's Russia now. And here's how Psaki responded.
Spring that Pentagon generals had...
Yeah, go back.
The president said in the spring that Pentagon generals had briefed him that the greatest threat facing America is global warming. Is that still the assessment now that we are facing down a potential cyber war with Russia?
Well, let me first cyber say there war. Is no... Well, we are always prepared for any threat that any outside entity or country poses to the United States that relates to cyber or anything else. There is no current pending threat on as it relates to cyber. In terms of the threats you're touching on, that was a briefing from the military. So I point you to them.
And so as far as anybody watching who's seen the coverage, it's very at times distressing images of Russian military movements. The number one threat facing the country right now remains global warming.
Yes.
Well, Peter, I think it's important, as we're all educating the public here, to convey and reiterate the president has no intention of sending U.S. troops into Ukraine to fight in Ukraine. What we are doing is we are abiding by our obligations to our NATO allies and partners to ensure that they have the support and the resources that they need. And that is our right and our obligation as the United States.
Okay. And why?
Yeah. So there's so much there. Can someone please ask Peter Ducey if oil and gas played any role in Russia's escalation in Ukraine? Because obviously it did. Why do you think Russia feels that can be so aggressive? Because with Saudi Arabia and the United States, they're the top oil producers in the world.
I mean, what's been our almost most explicit interest in this is the Nord Stream thing.
And same with Germany. That's part of what some of their hesitancy was to get involved. Over 25% of Germany's energy comes from Russian oil and gas. And so there is, of course, a reliance. And I mean, look at the past two wars, two major wars in Afghanistan. Well, I should say mostly just in Iraq, but the past war in Iraq that was had very much to do with oil and gas concerns. So, of course, that's a huge part of our national security. In fact, it's a driving force in our national security. A second point, I'm also amused by his sudden concern about cyber warfare by Russians. It's just interesting. I mean, I didn't hear that in 2016. Now, we're not going to get into Russiagate here. I'm not going to talk about, I mean, look, a lot of this was, it was overplayed, and I found it to be a laughable assertion by the United States that meddling in the way that Russia did was beyond the pale, given our very well-documented history. But regardless, they were, Republicans like Ducey were mocking that very notion just 5-6 years ago. So,
because
you know,
to their benefit.
Right, when it was to their benefit. Now they're very concerned about the national security threat of Russian cyber warfare. And besides all of that, the number one point is that the
direct consequences of climate change are clearly a bigger threat to us. I missed the part where Russia was lining up troops on the border of the United States. Or if they were off, you know, on aircraft carriers near our borders. No, that's not what's happening here. And the Biden administration has been explicit about not involving U.S. troops in combat there. Now, that can change. And then we're, you know, having a separate conversation. And their role is different than us. And we're trying to promote no death at pretty much at all costs. But for the global national security, for the national security of the United States specifically, as you know, people who work for the United States government, yeah, that makes a lot more sense that climate change is a greater national security threat to the country that's military is multiple times over the size of the next largest military after it. Yes, climate change, the existential threat of it, is the greatest threat to the largest army and defense systems on Earth by many times over. So, all right, folks, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Alex Kasar. We are back for now. We are just waiting on Alex for a little bit. No need to worry. We can get to some other stories in the meantime. We had a viewer write in a few times about this story, and I headlined it, but I wanted to make sure that we gave it its full attention because this is important. This is a story about a tragic and just honestly frightening and angering shooting in Portland. A woman was killed by clearly somebody who has been radicalized by the far right, and he also injured five other people at a Black Lives Matter anti-police brutality protest in Portland over the weekend. Now, the police shared his name yesterday. I don't really feel like saying it because I think, you know, a lot of times these people like notoriety and that's often what they're seeking. But this individual lived in an apartment complex or an apartment across from Normandale Park for more than a decade, has harbored growing animosity against Black Lives Matter protesters, COVID-19 mask mandates, unhoused Portlanders, and liberals, according to his roommate, Christine Christensen. Smith's brother told the Oregonian that Smith would often complain about the Justice for Patrick Kimmons demonstrations that regularly took place in Normandale Park. Kimmons was a Black man killed by Portland police in 2018. Kimmons supporters had gathered Saturday evening at Normandale to hold a demonstration in support of Amir Locke, a Black man killed by Minneapolis police earlier this month. Christensen told the Oregonian that Smith collected guns and kept at least four in his bedroom. He talked about wanting to go shoot commies and Antifa all the friggin' time, the roommate told OPB.
Yeah, I read some purported text chats of the guy, and it was talking on some Nazi forum, and one of the people made a joke. And this is important to think of in the context of who Abbott is delivering for in Texas with this anti-trans stuff. Mm-hmm. But saying things like, we have as many guns as they have genders. And this guy supposedly coming in and saying, no, you have to be ready to actually shoot. Don't pretend like this is just a joke, guys. We need to be serious about this stuff. So I mean, completely disgusting. And again, like, who's being appealed to by this sort of this bigotry and this anti-CRT stuff and this anti-Black Lives Matter backlash? It's these fascists.
These kinds of people, right? The roommate also added this quote, which is telling. He was just a sad, angry dude. He talked about wanting to do this for a while. He was angry at the mask mandates. He was angry at the damned liberals. So it all just, again, comes together in a stew of aggrievement. That's really what it is. And for people who are mentally unbalanced and radicalized at the same time, it turns into violence often. And this is heavily weighted on the side of the right wing.
Yeah,
and that's what these guys are, fascist foot soldiers, and they're being conditioned in this way.
And you know, Andy Ngo, who I would ban from Twitter, because I think he's a dishonest right wing propagandist with ties to the actual groups that like this sort of violence. That's my opinion. I would just say that. He said this is in response to Antifa sort of action, right? According to witness, Smith approached four unarmed women gathered near Normandale Park and yelled at them to leave. The women were all volunteers assisting march organizers in slowing down traffic to allow demonstrators to march down the street. And he started calling them bad names and stuff. And then they didn't like, or he didn't like them telling him to shut up. So he shot him.
Yeah. As I'm sure he probably speaks about how Black Lives Matter is excusing violence or looting, creating chaos and violence, doesn't respect law and order. I'm just going to go commit a murder.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They feel justified because of the radicalizing content, like what Matt described.
And I mean, that's Andy Ngo's role, I think, is to foment this sort of, we call it stochastic terrorism,
yep,
where it's this idea that you don't inspire or direct any given action, but you turn up the temperature and basically make people so bad about things like gender and Black Lives Matter protests that they take
a mask mandates.
It's all mandates.
The same thing.
Exactly. It's Nazism, remember? That's what the entire fucking Republican propaganda outlet from Charlie Kirk to Fox News has been saying. This is just like Hitler and Elon Musk too. Well, what do you do to the Nazis, right?
Yeah.
Right. What response does that?
What do you do to someone who stole the election?
Exactly. And so
the election was stolen, the democracy, and your guys, right? If you genuinely believe that, right? Exactly. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Hopefully, we'll be able to get Alex in. We are back, and we are joined by Alexander Kasar, Matthew W. Sterling, Jr. Professor of History and Social Policy at Harvard University, on his book, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Alex, thank you so much for being here today. It's all good. It's all good. It's kind of just the nature of the beast these days. But I'm looking forward to our conversation because I didn't realize how unpopular the Electoral College always was until to me in current day or in modern politics, it reminds me a bit of how Congress has a low approval rating all the time, or media. People want it to be changed, but it's likely that if any reforms or solutions were proposed, they would probably be met with seismic mistrust. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that. What's your diagnosis for why the Electoral College is so unpopular, not just today, I guess, but throughout history?
Well, the Electoral College, I think without doubt, the Electoral College has been our most unpopular institution. There were serious attempts to try to revise it or abolish it starting roughly 220 years ago. More constitutional amendments have been introduced in Congress to get rid of the Electoral College than on any other subject. And the polling data that we have, which is only goes back only to the 1940s, indicates that a majority of the American population would like to get rid of it. I mean, I think there are a number of different factors that that feed into this dislike, and some have been more salient at some periods than others. But the Electoral College doesn't conform to basic democratic values. It does not conform to one person, one vote. In its original design, it was subject to manipulation. For example, winner take all is not in the Constitution. That most states, 48 states, use winner take all stems from the fact from basically gaming the system, and most states figuring that they have more weight if they assign electoral votes on a winner take all basis, which of course distorts the process and makes it easier for somebody who didn't win the popular vote to be elected president. I mean, that's just for starters, in a way. But this is really a very unpopular institution. And we've come very close to getting rid of it on a couple of occasions.
Well, I'm hoping that you can lay out some of those occasions for us. But when you bring up the winner-take-all part of it, can you lay out how that came to be, or expand on it a bit? Because you talk a little bit about how the system was meant to mirror some of the separation of powers that exist in Congress, which right. also sometimes cause dysfunction. But that, I mean, the winner-take-all nature, you did say that's so states could kind of maximize their power, but that certainly isn't as in keeping with the proportional representation part of the House that they might have been trying to copy, I guess.
No, that's absolutely right. Look, the wording that the framers settled on was that electors will be chosen in such manner as the legislatures of each state shall decide. So constitutionally, the legislature of each state has a right to decide how electors will be chosen. In the first 10 years or 12 years, that varied. Legislatures sometimes had district elections, you know, where electors were chosen by district. And so the electoral vote of a state could have been 6-3. But as parties formed, and we have to remember that there were no political parties when the Constitution was written, but there was ferocious partisanship within about 10 to 15 years. And as parties formed, gaining partisan advantage looked like an increasingly important thing to do from the perspective of parties. So that what happened was that legislatures themselves chose electors, often on a winner-take-all basis, or they had elections and used winner-take-all. That went back and forth. There was a lot of jockeying about that for the first 30 or 40 years of the country's existence. And on five occasions, the Senate approved constitutional amendments that would have banned winner-take-all and required that electors be chosen by district. On one of those occasions, it passed the Senate and was only a few votes short of the needed two-thirds majority in the House. That was in 1821.
Wow.
So we came within a whisker of getting rid of winner-take-all after that. But then it didn't happen. And then, you know, the logic of everybody was well, if you're going to do it, then we're going to do it too.
Kind of what we're seeing with gerrymandering right now, right?
Exactly. You're gonna bend the rules. You're not gonna respect the spirit of the Constitution. Well, we're not going to either, and that's how we ended up with winner take all. There have been a lot of attempts since the 1840s to undo that. And states alone can decide to do that, but it's not necessarily in their partisan political interest to do so. I mean, right now, Maine and Nebraska do not use winner-take-all.
Right. And you mentioned how within, you know, a few decades, there was already intense partisanship in the country. That does seem to coincide with the calls for reforms at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century of the Electoral College. I mean, what was in the mindset of reformers at the time, people who wanted to change it? And it wasn't tweaked in the 12th Amendment. So, what was, I guess, the thinking of Americans and lawmakers at that time?
I think their thinking was that the system that they had created, which said you can choose electors in such manner as the legislature can decide, it had created two problems. One was that there was no uniformity across the country. Different states were using different systems, and that didn't seem like the right thing for a national election. And the second was that it was unstable. States were changing how they chose electors, depending on which political party was in power and what they thought was to their advantage. And you see this jockeying going on. I mean, switching back and forth, and fights going on about it. We often talk about the election of 1824, which was when John Quincy Adams became president, even though Andrew Jackson had more popular votes. And it's often said, well, Jackson won the popular vote. Well, a lot of states didn't hold elections, and there was no popular vote. New York, the legislature at the last minute just decided to choose electors by itself. So it was to end that kind of maneuvering and gaming of the system that reformers pressed again and again. And we should add here that they had as allies, people like James Madison, the leading framer of the Constitution. He himself thought the system should be changed. Mm.
But I mean, I would guess that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Madison and other Northern lawmakers were probably a lot more aligned in that perception than Southern lawmakers who, to this day, the lack of a national popular vote benefits.
Well, Madison was in fact from Virginia, but you're raising yet another issue and objection, which was that another part of the Constitution specified that each state would get a number of electors equivalent to the number of representatives it had in the House of Representatives plus two for its two senators. So it would mirror its congressional delegation. Well, those congressional delegations for the South were weighted upwards substantially by the three-fifths clause, which meant that Southern states got credit for towards seats in the House for three-fifths of their slaves. Northern anti-slavery leaders, representatives, senators, very much wanted to get rid of the three-fifths clause. But the South was unyielding about that, and, for good reason from their point of view. It would have meant a significant loss of power and likely the earlier abolition of slavery.
So another thing I wasn't aware of was that, or maybe I knew it, but it's just in the back of my mind somewhere, rattling around, that the term Electoral College is not in the Constitution. I mean, how did it then get so nationally codified so quickly?
Well, it didn't happen so quickly. That was a surprise to me, too, that it wasn't in the Constitution and that it was really so slow. You see almost no references to it in the first 10, 20, 30 years. And then the references are to the electoral colleges, which is the, you know, the meeting when New York State's electors meet in Albany on the specified day. That it was called a College of Electors of New York, or New Jersey's Electoral College. It was used as a plural. It's not until the 20th century, and I'm not exactly sure how it happens, that it becomes a reference to the entire system and the shorthand system. There's a book, for example, which, you know, arcane book that I and three other people have read, but it's a book written in the late 19th century by a legal scholar about the presidential electoral system. It's 700 pages long, and it never uses the term electoral college.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. And it's fascinating to me how our Constitution, it's supposed to be amended, right? And it was many times, and yet an institution that isn't even mentioned has a durability that other institutions have not, despite its flaws from the outset.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and with respect to the Electoral College, I mean, I think that it's fair to say that the framers in Philadelphia in 1787 did not regard this as their finest work. They had a lot of trouble deciding how a president should be chosen. And they went round and around all summer. They came up with the Electoral College only in a kind of mad dash process at the end of the summer. It was very hot in Philadelphia. They wanted to get out of there. They were under political pressure to come up with a draft of the Constitution. And they appointed a committee which really did it. And some of the framers even commented precisely to your point, saying, well, you know, this isn't so great, but we have a system for amending the Constitution. But in fact, amending the Constitution is a lot harder than they realized. You know, and if you think about it, after the Bill of Rights, which is passed in the immediate wake of the adoption of the Constitution, there have been less than 20 successful amendments to the Constitution in 200 years.
Right. I mean, it's unfathomable today that we would be able to achieve that. Even in the can you talk a little bit about the 20th century efforts? Because that gives us better context of how we took steps to entrenching this along the way.
Absolutely. The history did not end in 1840. And let me do this as a kind of, let me make two broad points here. One is that the advantage that Southern states got from the structure of the Electoral College did not end with slavery. It could have ended with slavery if, in fact, African Americans had been successfully enfranchised after the Civil War, and there was a constitutional amendment which seemed to enfranchise them. But in fact, what happens in the South in the late 19th century is that African Americans, despite the 15th Amendment, are completely disenfranchised, or 95% disenfranchised. At the same time, they are now counting 100%, not 60%, not 3/5, but 5/5 towards representation in Congress. So that in fact, but they are not able to vote, which means that white Southerners are getting even more clout in the selection of presidents than they had before. It's because to state this simply, the Electoral College is structured so that a state gets weight in the presidential vote depending on its population, not on how many voters it has. Okay, so that's part of the key backdrop here. It is the South that lobbies ferociously and resists and says it will not in any way permit Electoral College reform in the late 19th century and in the 20th century. Okay,
right. Yeah. And sure. So can you talk about Bai's effort in the? Yeah. What was it, 69 to 70-ish?
Yes. No, that is where I was headed.
I'm just easing you towards there.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was taking a circuitous path, I realize. things start to change in the 1960s, finally, for several different reasons. One, with respect to the South, is that the Voting Rights Act and a number of other pieces of legislation and court cases are succeeding in enfranchising African Americans. The other is there really is a growth of democratic sentiment and commitment to democratic ideology, which comes out of World War II, the Cold War also. And it's even underscored by very important Supreme Court decisions about Congress and state legislatures in the 1960s. And these are the court decisions which say you have to have one person, one vote, that all votes should count equally. And the Supreme Court really gives a ringing affirmation of that as a principle. And it doesn't take a great leap of imagination to say, well, shouldn't that apply to presidential elections also? So the pressure builds, and the effort is led in the Senate by Birch Bayh, an Indiana senator, a young liberal Indiana senator. There's also strong support in the House, very strong support in the House. And in fact, the House approves a constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College and replace it with a national popular vote in the late 1960s. And it does so, I think, as I recall, by an 82% positive vote, right? Democrats and Republicans, an overwhelming support. I mean, again, if you think today, it's hard to think that today's House of Representatives could get an 82% vote on what day it was.
Right.
But they got an 82% vote, and then it went to the Senate. And there were what you might call machinations and maneuvering over the course of a year as Bayh tried to navigate this through. Key committees were controlled by Southern white supremacist senators, including Alan Eastland of Mississippi, Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, and Sam Ervin of North Carolina. And in the end, they mounted a successful filibuster to prevent this constitutional amendment from being approved by the needed two-thirds vote in the Senate. It was a very bitter pill to swallow for reformers.
And I didn't know this, but this became a staple of Bayh's career going forward. And so it never really left the conversation, even though it was stymied, in that particular effort.
Oh yes. No. I mean, you know, they had lost by just a few votes and they deeply believed in this. And so Bayh brought it up again and again, in the '70s. And then, you know, with average success, and it wasn't going to happen really under Nixon. But then in the later 1970s, it comes up again. The House clearly will support an amendment. The Senate is the key arena. Basically, the same forces that defeated it, which is to say some very conservative Republicans coupled with white Southern representatives who were still very wary about changing the system in such a way as would encourage black turnout. Those folks block it again, although it has to be said that when the vote comes down in the Senate, there are some Northern liberals who vote against reform, a handful of them, and that's not decisive for the vote. The Southern and very conservative Republican vote really determined the outcome. But politically, the fact that several liberals abandoned the reform cause really is what killed it for a time politically. One of those Northern or quasi-Northern liberals who voted against reform, I'm sorry to say, was Joe Biden.
Well, I mean, I'm not particularly shocked. I mean, you mentioned Strom Thurmond a bit earlier in the show. Why was that? Was it Safe Blue, members of Safe Blue States found that actually, grouping or that the Electoral College, I guess, maybe helped their prospects in some way?
You know, it got very messy, and you know, in my book is long, and I know few people will read the whole thing, but I recommend this to people. It got messy. I mean, partly there was some sense of political safety, but there were two other things going on in the late 1970s. One was that there was a sizable segment of the black leadership of the country, not so much in Congress, but in the major black organizations, people like Vernon Jordan, very important, who came out against Electoral College reform. They were convinced, Jesse Jackson too, they were convinced that the black vote had been decisive in 1876 because of the Electoral College, that black voters had been key voters in swing states, and thus that the Electoral College magnified their power. And so there was a sizable segment of the African-American community or leadership and newspaper editors who switched position and were against Electoral College reform. So that some of those Northern liberals who voted against did so, in fact, in response to pressures from some black leaders. And black leadership is completely split. I mean, some members of Congress, like John Conyers of Michigan, are ardent reformers, but you know, other people are not. I interviewed Jesse Jackson, you know, for my book, and he sort of said we didn't get it. They were wrong, by the way. They thought that something was a permanent situation, which turned out to have been very peculiar to the election of 1976. The other constituency, for similar reasons, a much smaller population, the other constituency that waffled on the reform issue or that divided on the reform issue was the American Jewish community. In fact, all of the Jewish members of Congress voted in favor of reform, but some of the leading Jewish organizations again thought it would diminish the clout of American Jews because, as they conceived it at the time, Jews were swing voters in swing states and thus would be courted by both political parties.
So
again, it wasn't true.
Yeah, I mean, there's an inherently minoritarian quality to the Electoral College, and it seems to have manifested itself in microwaves as well.
Yes, in all sorts of microwaves. But you know, tying a couple of threads together, part of the reason it did so was because of winner take all. You know, if winning over the Jewish community in a state, you know, would increase your percentage of the vote by 2%, and the system wasn't winner take all, well, that's a 2% increment. If it's winner take all, it can mean a big block of electoral votes.
Right. Well, then now I guess before we have to say goodbye, I want to touch on the present day, because the Electoral College was pretty much universally despised. 2016 comes. Now it's like Republicans are maybe not so sure. Talk a little bit about where we are at in terms of perception currently and why Republicans have become more sympathetic. I mean, it seems a little fairly obvious, but I'm curious to hear your analysis.
Yeah, well, the turn really began in 1980, and it began with Reagan, and it began with the movement of the Republican Party becoming more conservative. And from the 1980s on, the Republican Party was locked into opposition to Electoral College reform because they believed, and they had various analyses that supported this, not very solid ones, but they believed that the Electoral College benefited the Republican Party and hurt the Democrats. And so since the early 1980s, there has been effectively almost no Republican support for Electoral College reform. and significant opposition. Now, their view, this view that it helps them, was of course been underscored by the fact that there were two presidential elections in 2000 and 2016 where the popular vote went for Democrats and the electoral vote went for Republicans. So that has convinced people further, Republicans further, that they can't give up the electoral college there. And, you know, one result of that has been a sense of partisan impasse in Congress, such that even many Democratic reformers feel that there is no point bringing it up, or there has been no point in bringing up the question again, because it's a sure loser in Congress, and certainly in the Senate, because they're not going to be able to get 2/3 votes. So that's where things are now. It's a partisan stalemate. But there's a period of the last 40 years, and, you know, even more extremely the last 5, 6, 7 years, has been the one period in U.S. history when partisanship has completely dominated the issue of electoral college reform and has prevented ideas for reform from being seriously considered. That's not the norm through 200 years of history, but it is where we are today.
Do you think that that's just because, based on, I mean, we have a 50-50 split in the Senate, and the Democrats 50 represent 40 million more people than the Republicans. And in terms of ideas, it's pretty clear where the population lies. Do you think that partisanship is increased by the fact that Republicans kind of seem to inherently benefit from minoritarian structure?
Yes. I think that's been true in their minds and in reality for 40 years with respect to the Electoral College, but now it's glaringly true with respect to all of our institutions, that Republicans do not believe that they can, that they could win majoritarian elections. I mean, you talk about the Senate being 50-50, but of course they represent very different numbers of people. Then again, the House is pretty close too, and that's more proportional to population. But I think that defending the Electoral College has now become a key prong of the preservation of the possibilities of minority government and minority power.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with me today. Everybody should check out Alexander Kasar's book. It is called Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? Alex, thank you so much. Glad we were able to power through with any technical difficulties.
So am I. Thank you very much for inviting me to talk about this.
Of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour of the show. We are back. Anyway, that is going to be it for the first hour of the show. Matt, Left Reckoning is tonight, I do believe, good sir.
Yeah, Left Reckoning is tonight. It is a pre-taped episode, which we can't specify why. More on that in the coming weeks.
I know.
But we have a fun show. Chase Woodruff, he's a reporter out of Colorado for Colorado Newsline. He also has a Substack called Lit Out West, which, you know, speaks to me. He focuses on, we talk about what was possibly the first American Western, a book by John Rollins Ridge called The Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta. And we talk about that book and how General Ellen's Ridge's father was one of the Cherokees who signed the treaty that led to the Trail of Tears. So he had a first row look at racial conflict and stuff in America. And he wrote a novel about it in 1854. So we talk a little bit about that. We talk about a story out of Douglas County in South Denver, I believe, where the school board, the right-wing anti-CRT folks took a narrow majority over the school board and wanted to get rid of a superintendent that's been there for 25 years because they had like some equity policies. And there's a massive sick out and people like are mobilizing against the CRT lunacy, which is nice to see. So we talk about that as well. And get into Elon Musk, the extremely racist factory in Fremont, California, and him abusing animals. A lot of this stuff explains a little bit of why he might be moving to Texas and the culture as far as like, can you have a place called the plantation where you segregate black workers into your factory? Well, Texas might be a little bit more, slow to like file a lawsuit on stuff like that. So anyway, all that tonight, patreon.com/leftreckoning to watch the show. And I'll be doing a Twitch stream afterwards in lieu of the post game.
Oh, very cool. All right. We are going to head into the fun half 6462573920. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee or chocolate. Use the code majority, get 10% off your order. Boom. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 6462573920. See you in the fun.
Oh no! Are you ready?
Oh yeah! Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if there are enough little breaks.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africa. alpha males are black. Black Africans are back. Back.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total
pussy.